Okay.
They are ready. We could start with. It's on now? There's Rick.
There's Rick.
Started.
Hello.
This meeting of the Legislative Energy Commission will. This meeting of the Legislative Energy Commission will come to order. We're going to be hearing presentations from utilities on electric prices and the pressures driving them in a minute. And we'll start with a quick update from the Executive Director, Ms. Levinson-Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. As usual, there's a page of Executive Director updates in your packets and out there for the public. Just to start out, I'd like to invite any LEC members or any members of the legislature, your staff, if you have energy policy questions or energy resource questions during the session, I'm happy to help with those. So I just encourage you to contact me if there's anything that I could do to help with that kind of research. I am working on a document that is going to give some background on energy and energy policy in Minnesota, kind of the big picture of what energy production and use looks like in Minnesota, and an outline of the major energy statutes that get addressed at the legislature. So background for folks on all of that, and that should be out within the next week or two. So I'll distribute that to the LEC members and staff, and it'll be posted on our website for any members of the public that would like to see it as well. And finally, I just would like to continue to encourage any members of the public that wish to comment on the topic of energy prices that we're looking at in the LEC meetings throughout the year to contact me, either phone or email, submit written comments if you would like. I've heard from comments from two individuals, which are printed in your packets, and they're printed up there for the members of the public that are here so far, but I would welcome additional comments on the topic.
Thank you. And we're going to start our presentations with Al Krug from Xcel. Is he here yet? Not yet. If he's not, maybe we'll start with Minnesota Power. Okay. Welcome to the committee. We start with you. Welcome, and go ahead when you're ready.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. I appreciate the opportunity to share some information from Minnesota Power's perspective on what's been driving changes in energy rates over the last 10 years. And the first slide that I have up here is really a quick graphical snapshot of how we're transforming our resources and we call it our Energy Forward Plan, and it really is how Minnesota Power is transforming the generation sources that we use to serve our customers. And so if we go back to 2005, we were a 95% coal-based generation utility, and the other 5% was mostly made up of our hydro. And we are in the process of transforming into roughly one-third coal, one-third natural gas and other, and one-third renewables. And so we're well underway to meeting that strategy. And then the points along that arrow listed up above are the different steps that we're taking to get to that ultimate goal of one-third, one-third, one-third. The next slide here, the power supply principles slide, just demonstrates a few of the key principles that we're using as we are making that transformation. And so what we're trying to do as we change our resource mixes to look at resources that are flexible, diverse, and efficient, and resources that have fewer emissions, lower fixed costs, and lower carbon emissions. And so by emissions, we're talking about SO2, NOx, mercury, and CO2. And then some of the ways that we're looking at reducing carbon emissions include more wind generation and more hydro generation. So those are some of the key aspects of that. The The next slide here just demonstrates some of the investments that we've already made. So from 2005 going up until through the end of 2015, and we started out at just over $500 million is what our rate base was, and that's what basically is driving our rates for our customers. And by the end of 2015, we had just over $2.5 billion in assets. And so we have made a lot of investments, and we'll talk about those investments here coming up. But that is really a good picture of how our rate base or the resources that we have invested in to serve our customers have changed over that time. And so that includes both transmission and generation assets is really what's driving that. And this next slide talks about some of the buckets, if you will, so the key components of the investments that we have made. And so the first one that I like to talk about is environmental compliance projects that we've done. And so these are projects that we've invested in our thermal generation. And the largest two projects there are our largest coal units in Cohasset, our Boswell 3 and our Boswell 4 units. And so we put scrubbing technology into that facility, and just the Boswell 3 and 4 investments were about $600 million of that $700 million, but we've invested about $700 million in our just cleaning up thermal plants. The next bucket or piece of the investments that we've made are really in renewable energy, and so that's primarily wind. We built about 500 megawatts of generation in North Dakota, and that is the bulk of our renewable energy. We've also made additional investments in hydro production as well. But between the wind and the hydro, that makes up the bulk of the renewable investments. And then the last piece on this slide is really the investments that we've made in our transmission system. So there's been significant investment in our transmission assets as well. And to date, that includes purchase of the DC line going from North Dakota into Duluth, and then also we are starting to make some initial investments in our Great Northern Transmission Line from Canada into Duluth as well. This next slide really shows the benefits or what some of the environmental benefits that we've gotten out of those investments. And so as our loads have actually increased about 20% since 2005, our CO2 emissions have actually decreased by 30% because of the change in the resources that we have on our system. Besides CO2, we also have significant reductions in other emissions, so that would include sulfur dioxide, NOx gases, particulates, and mercury. And so those have all been reduced substantially as well. And in particular, mercury has been reduced over 90%, and those other emissions have been reduced by between 70 and 80%. And now stepping into the rate impact, which is the key point of the meeting here today, those investments have driven some significant increases in our rates, and this is a graphical example of our residential rates. And so from 2005, our average residential rate was about 7 cents. That rate has gone up to about 10.5 cents by the end of 2015. And that green line on that chart illustrates the increase in the residential rate. This next rate is our large industrial rates. And so this would be our taconite mines, our paper mills, those large industrial customers. And so they've seen similar rate increases over time as well. So stepping back to discuss the residential customers and what are the key drivers of that rate increase. So as I had mentioned, we did see about a 3.5 cent increase in our residential rate. So what was driving that 3.5 cent increase? Fuel and purchased energy is a big component. And so over the last 10 years, we've seen the delivered cost of fuel and also the cost of purchases that we need to make from the market. Those costs have gone up significantly over the last 10 years. The next big cost bucket that's driven up the rates is our transmission costs. And as you know, our transmission costs over time, they do get rolled into to MISO costs. And so those costs are basically socialized over the MISO footprint. And so those transmission costs, everyone in the MISO region is really seeing a similar increase in those costs. And then I had already talked about some of the environmental projects on our thermal units that we've made. And so that's a big driver in our cost increase. And then the other includes a lot of other smaller pieces. So that would include things like property tax increases. When we invest in new assets, that's going to drive up our property taxes. We've made investments in our distribution system and A&G expenses and things like that. And then finally, the last one, it has a relatively small overall impact on our costs, is the investments that we've made in our wind generation. And so even though we've made a lot of investments, because that's a zero fuel cost energy source and there's tax credits associated with the generation that's produced, it actually has a very minimal impact, at least the investments that we've made up until this point, on the customer's bills. And so as we are looking forward, a couple of the things that I just wanted to mention here was renewable and solar energy standards. And so as I had mentioned, in meeting the renewable energy standard, the investments that Minnesota Power has made so far have been very competitive with both the existing generation assets that we had or the lowest cost other units. So if we were to look at a natural gas fired generator, it's very competitive with those types of generation resources. However, on the solar side, that is still a higher cost. That is still a higher cost generation source at this point. However, costs are going down. So we are continuing to see the costs of installed solar declining as the years go by here, and they seem to be declining rapidly, especially over the last couple of years. And then also looking ahead, some of the things that Minnesota Power is focusing on to try to control costs, we have, in 2015, we've reduced our number of employees by over 100 people at this point already. And so that's a fairly large percentage of our workforce. It's roughly 8%. And so we've made significant reductions in order to try to control our costs, and we're looking at a lot of O&M, other O&M cost reduction efforts as well. So we have been focusing very hard on trying to control costs that we can. And then a couple of other points here, capital expenditure, timing, and management. We want to very carefully control how frequently we are, or the timing of the capital investments that we're making. And so we've tried to space out our capital investments to avoid rate shock. We don't want to make big investments all at once that are going to have a very large impact on a customer's rates in a very short period of time. So we've been trying to manage the pace of those investments. And then finally, the fuel cost management is something that we are very careful to work with as well. And so on fuel cost management, we are working very hard to control our delivered cost of fuel for our coal units, and we are also working very hard to balance the wind energy, and that's part of the strategy that we have with our Manitoba Hydro purchase. So we are investing in the Great Northern Transmission Line, so we'll have access to dispatchable hydropower, which means that we can take hydro from Canada when we need it, when the wind isn't blowing in North Dakota, and when the wind is blowing hard in North Dakota, we can back off on our hydro purchases. And so it's almost a way to manage the intermittent nature of those wind resources, is by having that access to an offsetting renewable generation resource, because it's hydro that has no carbon emissions, but yet it is dispatchable. And so that's all the slides that I have. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Representative Hortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. on one of your pages where you're talking about the breakdown of the cost impact on residential rates, there's stars under each of those things, and I was wondering if the number of stars mean anything.
It does, yeah. The stars do represent basically the relative impact of that item. And so the fuel and purchased energy, that was the largest percentage increase. And so in round numbers, you know, if we look at a 3.5 cent increase from 2005 to 2015, it's roughly a penny of that 3.5 cents was due to fuel and purchased energy over time.
Mr. Chair, I have like six or five, looks like. Do you want me to ask them all once? Okay.
That first question was the one I was going to ask too, what the stars meant, whether.
It's like on Yelp, right? More stars is better. So which fuels have increased in price and which have decreased? Do you have a sense of, I don't know what's happening over this period of time, 05 to 16. I recall there was extremely high natural gas prices for a time, and now they're extremely low. And I presume coal has been on a pretty steady trajectory downward. But I'm wondering what other fuels.
Yeah, so Chair and committee members, on that question, Minnesota Power, our thermal generation is primarily coal. And so when we see the fuel and purchased energy cost increases, it for the fuel that we use, it's primarily the coal and the delivery cost. So both the cost of coal and the rail over time has gone up. And then also the cost of purchased energy from MISO has also gone up. And so both of those things are really what is driving that. So the fuel and purchased energy for us is coal and delivery, and then the purchased power costs.
And then two more questions. One, what would the retail rate be if the PUC would have approved the request to shift that commercial industrial load to the residential ratepayers? My understanding was 14%. Do you know where that what the cents per kilowatt hour would have been for the retail rate if that would have been approved?
Yeah, that I did not do the math on that, but it would be roughly 14% over the 10.5 cents, and so we'd be looking at another about cent to a cent and a half, roughly in that range.
And then I heard, but I'm not certain of this because I haven't read about it, that the Public Utilities Commission sent Minnesota Power back to the drawing board on one element in the solar energy standard. We exempted your commercial and industrial users from having to pay any investment for any cost that your company would incur in meeting the standard. And my understanding is the PUC sent the mathematicians back to the drawing board and said, well, if they don't invest in it, they also don't get any of the benefits. So like on July 15th at 3 p.m. when you're buying energy on MISO for 24 or 32 cents a kilowatt hour, that they don't get the benefit. Can you tell us a little bit about that docket and where that stands?
I'm sorry, can you repeat the question, please?
Sure. In the legislation, when we passed the solar energy bill, we exempted the commercial and industrial users in the Iron Range from bearing any of the cost of Minnesota Power complying with the solar energy standard.
Mm-hmm.
And my understanding is that the Public Utilities Commission looked out and said, yes, that your calculation excluded them from the cost, but it didn't exclude them from the benefits. So down the road, when actually the folks who paid for the investments in solar have actually lower electricity rates during certain parts of the summer, they wanted to make sure that those in the commercial and industrial sector that didn't pay for the investment in solar then later on don't benefit from it. Do you know where that docket is? And am I understanding it correctly?
Yes, Chair and committee members, I will have to get back to you on that. And I'm not familiar with the status of that docket and where that is. So I
thank you.
I'm not able to answer that question. We will get back to you on that, Bill.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned that your company has spent about $700 million in environmental compliance. That's a huge figure. And I'm just wondering, as a company, what do you get for that? Is it just buying some time before the Clean Power Plan shuts these plants down? Or what's the long-range outlook, at least in your opinion, on these plants?
Yeah, Chair and committee members, the investments that we made are primarily, like I had mentioned, at our Boswell plant, so our Boswell units 3 and 4. And those investments were made to comply with actually a few different emissions rules. And so the investments were made to comply with mercury, SOx, NOx, and other particulate emissions rules. And so we will be positioned to continue to operate that facility for the long term. And so we're looking at those being very long-term assets now. And in order to continue to operate those assets long term, we did need to make the investments. And so that is what basically we received you know, from a utility perspective, it enables us to continue operating those assets, and those are very critically located generation assets. They're right in the Iron Range where the bulk of our load is, and so it's very important to maintain the integrity of the transmission system and to serve those customers that are located there, and it's also very reliable base load generation, and so that's basically the one of the key things that we got as a utility, and then also we saw those emissions reductions as well. So we didn't get any more megawatt hours or any more generation out of those assets due to the environmental investments that we made, but we were able to reduce the emissions, you know, 70% to 80%, and then over 90% for mercury, and then we were also able to continue operating those assets long term, where if we would not have made the investments, they would not have complied with the emissions rules that are in place today or that will be in place soon.
Mr. One question on the page of the significant increase in investments. It shows that your asset base in 2005 was just over $500 million. I assume that means that your equipment was fairly well depreciated by then. What was the newest generating facility you had prior to 2005? I'm just curious how old most of these were, if that's the total asset base you had.
Yeah, Chair and committee members, basically we did have an older fleet, and so a lot of it was fairly old. And so as we look at our Boswell units, our newer Boswell units were constructed in the late 70s, early 80s, and some of our smaller coal generation units, our smaller Alaskan coal-fired plants, those were constructed in the 60s. We also were operating some older units, but we had purchased them more recently. So we bought the old LTV mining generation, which we call that Taconite Harbor, and we purchased those right around 2000, 2001. However, those are 60s vintage generation units as well. And so that really was the bulk of our fleet. Our hydro assets are dating back to 100 years or more. And so yeah, we did have a very relatively old generation fleet.
Because I was surprised how low it was in there. Okay, that explains it. Are there any other questions? Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I like to, you know, when we look at the reason why rates are going up, there's like the stuff happens category of things where no one really took any action. It's just kind of the world changing. Things happen. Rates are going up, and they're impacting everyone. And then there's other things where there's public policy decisions where we've made a decision, and we've either, you know, made a trade-off that we think is worth it. An example of that would be 2006. We just decided that, you know, mercury is a neurotoxin. It's a bad thing. And whether the mercury lands here or somewhere else, that's a really bad thing. And we said we're willing to spend more money to significantly reduce mercury. And those sorts of policy considerations. So putting aside the stuff happens category of the rate increases, and I'm making up my own categories here, I know. But just give us a top-line overview for people who have short attention spans. Give us the factors and say these are the things that public policymakers have decided that are costing more money. And you don't need to, I mean, you can choose to decide whether you talk about the benefits on them or not, but just in terms of sometimes people get the impression that we're paying more and we're not getting anything in return for it. In fact, we are getting something in return for it. We're getting cleaner energy. And so can you just talk about what those public policy decisions are? You don't need to mention the benefits, but just what are the public policy decisions that we've made as a legislature that are driving your costs up?
Yes, Chair and committee members, that's a good question. And one of the things, if we go back to that slide, I'm just going to page back there if I could. And so if we move back to the slide that shows for a residential customer who's seen their rate go up roughly 3.5 cents, as we look at the list of items here and the asterisks that show the relative impact of the increases, so the fuel and purchased energy cost, I would say that is not really being driven by public policy. That's more of just the cost of rail and coal. And however, when we get into the transmission costs, you could make the argument that a lot of the transmission infrastructure that's been built has been built to extend transmission to new wind farms in the MISO area. And so the percentage of that transmission work that's been done to connect to renewable energy sources like wind, I don't know the difference between how much is dedicated to renewable connections and how much is just due to overall system reliability. So that's definitely a part of the transmission costs is due to public policy, particularly as we look at connecting to wind facilities. And then the environmental improvement piece, that's definitely a piece that has been impacted by public policy. So that's probably, again, that's probably about 1 cent in round numbers of the 3.5 cent increase is just the investments that were made in the, in this case for us, primarily our Boswell 3 and 4 coal-fired units. Yeah. So I would say in round numbers, and there's some estimation going on there, but I'd say about a third of that is directly due to some of the public policy. A third to a half of the rate increases is due specifically to some of the public policy.
And Mr. Chairman, and
Representative Ruffel.
And Representative Hartman alluded a little bit to this. So obviously, coal prices are cheaper than they used to be. That's a primary fuel source. So it's primarily transport that is the. It's not the commodity. It's the actual transporting of that. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe are coal prices higher than they used to be?
They are higher than they were in 2005. So they are lower than they were a few years ago, the coal prices. But overall, the trend in delivered coal costs is definitely higher. So the rail has been increasing steadily over that period of time. And then the coal itself, too, that is higher than it was in 2005.
Mr. Chairman, my final question. Just now that we're kind of seeing things chill out in North Dakota and oil, while it's still crowding the railways, isn't crowding it as much. Are you guys, is it too soon to see if you're seeing any reduced prices in your transport for coal?
Chair and committee, I would say that's a question that our rail costs aren't directly correlated to the amount of traffic. It is a factor, but we actually had a rail contract that was a very long-term contract, and anytime we negotiate a new contract with our transportation providers, the rate is bound to change. And because we were transitioning from a contract that had been negotiated a long time ago, rates had gone up. And so we did see an increase in our rail costs, and we have seen costs. We've had staggered contracts for our rail supply, and we have seen costs continue to escalate over time, essentially. And I wouldn't say that it's directly related to the amount of traffic, like I say, on the rails, although that does have an impact. A lot of it is related to fuel costs and other capital investments that the railroad companies are making.
Do you guys get your coal primarily from like Montana, North Dakota?
Yeah, Montana, Wyoming.
Okay. Yep. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rizzo. Appreciate your presentation. Al Krug from XL. Welcome to the commission, and please begin when you're ready.
Good evening, members of the commission. First, I'd like to apologize for being tardy today. I underestimated the traffic coming from Minneapolis. It was impossible to get a ticket because there was nowhere to go. Yes, there was a parking lot. So I thank you for the time today. I would just say, first of all, I'm Al Krug. I'm Vice President of Regulatory Policy with XL Energy, and just to preview a little bit, in listening to Minnesota Power's presentation, mine is a little more geared towards first some simple math in case you had questions about how rates are put together, and then second, it's a bit more forward-looking rather than what's caused increases in the past, but I'd certainly be able to answer any questions regarding that as well. First of all, just very briefly, who we are. Obviously, we're a multi-state utility. In the upper Midwest, we serve customers. We have both natural gas and electric customers in five states, actually. The Dakota, North and South Dakota, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and then a very small piece of Michigan. And then we also serve Colorado and Texas and New Mexico. So just table setting a bit. I didn't realize I'd get that pop-up there, but 1.4 million customers in Minnesota, and we have in excess of 6,000 employees in our upper Midwest area. And just to highlight, we do really hard to be good corporate citizens and be an integral part of our communities. I foreshadowed some very simple utility rate math. And I really just, when we're trying to set rates, just to table set, I just tried to break it into three categories. Essentially, we're permitted by statute, and the commission reviews our requests, but ultimately we're permitted an opportunity to recover our costs and earn a fair return on our investments. And so the first category of costs I would just call very generally operating and maintenance costs. And those could be all of the costs to run a utility. And I threw fuel in here only to make it a little simpler, although in rate making, fuel is often treated a little differently. But nonetheless, it's a variable cost. It's not a fixed cost. And so there's costs of fuel, employee salaries and their benefits, a variety of miscellaneous maintenance costs, including contractor costs, that go into the general day-to-day running of our system and delivering reliable energy to our customers. The second category of costs, if you will, is a required return on our investment. So, for example, anytime we invest or, for example, build a new power plant, we need to raise capital from the capital markets, and that's a combination of both equity and debt. And so obviously our shareholders require a certain return in order to invest in our company. And as well as when we issue long-term debt, we need to pay what the market is bearing at that time. And so all those costs, if you will, need to be also recovered, and we need a reasonable opportunity to recover those. So if you look at the numerator, those are our costs. And in a rate proceeding, we're projecting all of these costs. And we're also projecting our sales. And so really, that's the result of that, dividing our costs by our sales, ultimately ends up in what we forecast to be our rates, and those will vary by class and also by for some customers by time of day. Recently, our recent experience is the denominator has not been increasing at historic rates, and in fact, in some recent years, has actually fallen, and that has actually somewhat contributed to our price increases for our customers over time. So, again, just trying to table set with some math. And then, as I said, I was hoping to just look forward a little bit. As some of you may know, we recently filed a rate case last fall. And actually, we did something unique as a result of some recent last year's legislation, which permitted us to file a five-year multi-year plan. And so what you're looking at here is really the drivers from our five-year request. We actually provided two options, a three-year plan and a five-year plan. This is really, just to give you as long a look as possible, this is our five-year plan. And I just tried to classify these in a pie chart here what was really driving our request. And the biggest category is production, which is really primarily our investments and increasing maintenance costs for our generation facilities. The primary one, the primary driver there being our investments in our nuclear facilities. Our The way rate cases are conducted, we aren't permitted to recover our costs from new investments in generation until they're in service. And so while the Monticello plant has been operating for a while now, and we've gone through the life extension, due to the timing of rate cases, there is some lag, and so some of the costs related to prior investments are now being seen in this case. We're also investing heavily in our Prairie Island nuclear facility. And whenever you make new investments, operating and maintenance costs tend to be correlated with that to a certain extent. In our transmission area, similar to Minnesota Power, many of you have heard of CapEx 2020, which was a very large effort by a number of utilities working collaboratively to upgrade our transmission system, both to increase reliability and deliverability, and also to a certain extent, to increase access to our renewables, which are primarily historically have been wind resources to the west, the southwest Minnesota, and also in the Dakotas. And again, as those transmission investments have been increasing, you also have to maintain and upgrade other lines at the same time, and so that has also been a contributor. On the distribution side, let me just back up just for a minute. These numbers here, 127 is 127 million. The total increase over this five-year period is about 13% that we have requested, and it varies by year. Actually, the first year is pretty front-loaded, and it's about 8%, and so most of that increase would come in what our request is in the first year. The distribution is really what you see is the poles and wires and upgrading and increasing resiliency for that system, which we feel is very important and actually, for the most part, has the biggest impact on improving customer satisfaction and reliability for our customers. The other category are sometimes it's hard to classify, for example, accounting systems and computer systems and related costs that support all of these other categories are in that, quote, other category and are sometimes hard to define. And so that makes up about 8% of those costs over that five-year period. And so just a fairly quick summary of what's going on in our current case. Wanted to give you a little longer look about what we see the future is going to look like. And actually, this is a chart that we submitted in our most recent resource plan filing, where actually we've mapped out over the next 15 years where we see prices going. And as you can see, it's a bit of a confusing graphic because we have really three different plans layered on there. One was our original plan for managing our system, which included handling keeping our coal units, all of our coal units intact, but managing them from an energy perspective a little differently. Another one was a revised plan where we had a more accelerated closure of two of the facilities in Becker County. The national average is also layered in here as that red dotted line. As you can see, over that 15-year period, we expect to be our rates to be increasing about what the national average is, and that the source of that information is EIA data. So that's about the best source we have at this time. And likely, regardless of what we do, we see ourselves being in about the 2 to 2.3% range per year. And this would include all of the various, regardless of what we ultimately do with our coal facilities, we'll need to continually be modernizing our system, adding generation and transmission and also distribution resources all through this period. And it also Embedded in here are assumptions about the cost of various fuels, including natural gas and coal. So again, these are forecasts. They certainly, our actual requested increases will certainly vary from this plan on a year-to-year basis, but ultimately this is where we see ourselves over the next 15 years. And I believe that concludes what I wanted to provide today, and you know, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Representative Ortman.
Sorry to be Hermione Granger about all this. On the second slide, you have the $20 million in corporate giving. I'm wondering what the revenues are, total revenues for NSP Minnesota annually.
For just the Minnesota jurisdiction, I would say that the total revenues are probably in the $2.5 billion range.
Do you know system-wide what the number would be? Or company-wide?
That number, I apologize. I would have to go back and check that. If you wanted me to include Colorado and the entire system, I don't have that on hand.
I tried to read it in your rate case once, but reading a rate case is a little sticky for the uninitiated.
You're a sad woman.
Sad. If I had be able to combat your points on the House floor that I was making electricity more expensive. So then we get to the next issue. What was the original quote for the upgrade at Monticello, and what was the final price?
Well, when you just so I make sure I answer the question, when you say original, are you Let me try to answer it as best I can. I would say when in the Monticello upgrade went through a series of our initial estimates were likely around in the $300 to $350 million range to extend the life of the Monticello facility. At that time, we also anticipated at the same time providing a small power uprate to that as well, so we would squeeze more megawatts out of the same machine. Ultimately, due to for a variety of reasons, including increasing NRC regulations resulting from, well, obviously for some, you know, Fukushima was part of that, I think we came closer to about $700 million for that.
And then the last question is on the pie chart of the five-year cost drivers looking at the 13% increase, is there a projection for how for rates going up because consumption's going down? And how would that be in the other category?
Well, actually, there is some small sales increase embedded in there. So I would just say that rates would we traditionally had rates or sales going up around 2 to 3% range, and now they're going up at a less than 1% range. And so to the extent that sales are growing slower than before, obviously prices are higher. But they aren't negative at this point. They are growing slightly.
Thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks again, Mr. Chair. I have a question that's more of a general question, not particular to Excel, and I'm going to go back to coal again. I read someplace, maybe it was in the updates we get, that I think it was in January, that nationwide the coal utilization rate of power plants was like 45% or something like that. Now, that isn't very efficient. I'm just wondering what's happening in the industry. Is it, you know, a decrease in demand or other sources of power generation becoming cheaper? Why the low rate on coal plants?
Well, a couple of reasons. Well, first of all, let me just respond. For our system, our capacity factors or our utilization rate is quite a bit higher than that at our coal facilities, but nonetheless, they have fallen, and the industry has really changed a lot about how we use our facilities. Because we're a member of MISO and there's a very active daily and hourly market, we're able to interact all the time with that market. Also, wind resources, particularly overnight, are you know, we have quite a few wind resources. So As wind resources and other market factors push down prices, market prices, we often do ramp down and follow that. We'll ramp down our coal units to get those benefits for our customers. And so what we try to do is dispatch all of our resources to benefit our customers. The only resources that really aren't flexible in that way are our nuclear plants. They need to be run at a flat capacity at all times for safety reasons. But in general, what's happened over the entire industry is, market pressures have forced all market participants to be more flexible with all of their resources.
Representative Portman.
Sorry, just one follow-up. On the revenues question, I asked what the revenues were, and you said $2.5 billion. Do you know what the profits were for the most recent year reported?
If our earnings, I don't want to misstate it, but I'd be happy to get back to you with that.
Okay. Thank you.
I apologize.
I would appreciate that.
Mr. Kuh, with when I look at the chart of the forecasted price trends, it's very small, but it looks like it's a very smooth line and kind of a roughly the same percent each year. I think you were saying earlier in the next 5 years it's actually front-loaded and so on. So I'm not going to assume that's as smooth as it looks, but just curious in terms of like transmission upgrades that you need for, like you mentioned, CapEx, but for maintenance, and I keep hearing numbers that nationally our electric grid is declining. In other words, we're going to have to do more maintenance, more upgrades than have done in the past, and that could be a huge hit. You have a lot of your big plants going offline sometime in the next 15 to 20 years. Is this relatively stable because of the fact that you're planning them in a scheduled thing? Because it seems to some of those would be huge hits and others, I mean, is it because you're spacing it out that it's relatively level?
Yes, I think you've captured what our plan is to space them out as best we can, and you are correct. We have several fairly large decisions to make related to our baseload facilities all throughout the 20s, including at Sherco, also our we have a contract with Manitoba Hydro that is up for renewal. We also have our nuclear facilities are not too far along, although it's out of this planning period. But all of these fairly large baseload decisions are assumed to be spaced out. We have been able to smooth things out a bit by one of the advantages with, and we've been able to take advantage of very favorable renewable prices, particularly in wind. And that's allowed us to add, and we will continue to add wind in relatively small chunks compared to what the industry used to be like when you needed to add in 500 to 1,000 megawatt chunks. And so we're able to do that and a little smooth that out and take advantage of very favorable prices. So you are correct. That is mostly because we're able to smooth out many of the large increases.
Further questions? Not. Thank you very much for your presentation.
You.
Mr. Brecky from GRE.
Good evening, Senator, members of the Commission. Thanks for the invitation to be here tonight. I want to start on a positive note. We're in good shape competitively at Great River Energy. Our rates are about in the middle of Minnesota utilities for generation and transmission costs, and that's according to an independent study that we had commissioned. So about half of the utilities serving Minnesota have higher rates than Great River Energy, about half have lower. We kind of represent the average right now. Another piece of good news, our rates went down in 2015, so first year in a while that rates actually went down to our member cooperatives. Over the next 10 years, we expect rate increases below 2% a year, and we're just going to be showing our members that forecast at regional meetings that we have scheduled for next week. So that'll be good news. We think we have similar cost drivers to other utilities serving Minnesota load, and we're about average in that regard, so we'll talk about some of those drivers today. From a renewable energy standard perspective, you know, we're on track. We find it to be a manageable goal, and we're voluntarily going beyond it, and we appreciate that it's voluntary. We appreciate the ability to do voluntary things beyond it. Measures like our EV program, Revolt program, where we give renewable energy credits to purchasers of electric vehicles on our system for the life of the vehicle. They get wind energy at no additional cost. And also our community solar program. Our member cooperatives continue to build community solar and sell subscriptions at a rapid clip. And I think we're examples. Our co-ops are examples of community solar programs nationally, and that's a very positive thing. So a lot of good things to start with. A summary of what I'll cover today. The drivers for us really of the past 10 years and kind of going forward, fuel costs have gone up, and that's at our Mine Mouth plant. That's lignite coal. Still a very competitive cost for fuel at our flagship plant, Coal Creek Station. It's 1,100 megawatt facility, but the fuel costs have gone up since 2005. The fuel is getting farther away from the plant. It's deeper underground, so the costs have gone up somewhat. We are investing in emissions reductions. That has had an impact on our rates. We've added a lot of renewable energy toward meeting Minnesota's standard and toward voluntary measures that I talked about. We're investing in efficiency and reliability of our plants. You know, Coal Creek Station, we've reduced our carbon dioxide emissions by 4% by drying the coal before we burn it. It's a patented technology. We also got 54 more megawatts out of that plant with no more fuel by switching to a more efficient rotor design. So we're making investments in efficiency and reliability. Those do have rate impacts, but they also have some benefits. Now, the wholesale energy market, you asked about that earlier, that market has fundamentally changed, and that is having an impact on us and all utilities in this region. We're not going back to the market we had in 2007. The market now is really driven by low natural gas prices and the advent of a lot of wind energy in the market that has no variable cost and is being offered into the market for zero cost. It's a price taker, not a price setter. So that has really kept a lid on prices. We're seeing sustained low prices since 2009 in this market. We don't expect to be going back to 2007 levels, at least in a sustained way. Now, we may get back to natural gas price increases at some time, but that'll affect us predominantly at peak times. In the off-peak hours, we're still going to be a wind-driven market. So our future outlook is really going to be driven by our portfolio transition and trying to reduce carbon. All utilities are faced with this. We're a part of that, and we expect to be on the trajectory to reduce carbon in our portfolio as we've done since 2005 and continuing going forward. A little bit about co-ops in Minnesota. The co-ops that serve Minnesota were not-for-profit. We provide energy at cost to our members that own us. So we're democratically controlled with a board of directors made up of elected representatives. We are oriented to serve our members, and our focus is on reliability and cost management. This is a map roughly of our service territory. We serve 28 member cooperatives in Minnesota that in turn serve 1.7 million people. We have $4 billion in assets. We're the fourth largest generation and transmission cooperative in the country. About $1 billion in revenue on our system. And we serve a small part of Wisconsin, as you can see on the map, but predominantly Minnesota. We have a little over 900 employees. A little over half of those employees are in Minnesota, the rest being in North Dakota. And 3,600 megawatts of generation. You can see the amount of renewables there and the miles of transmission. By miles of transmission, we own the most transmission in Minnesota by miles. We have a board of directors of 26 members elected by our member consumers, and they come from our member boards. They set our power rates, our budgets, our policies, our strategies, and our members elect that board, and they approve all the resource decisions of GRE. So not only does our board have to approve a resource addition, it goes out to a vote of our members. All 28 of those members have long-term contracts with GRE for supply, and to try to mimic a contractual approach to vertical integration and the benefits that come with that. If we're serving load, we have long-term agreements for generation to meet those requirements. We meet every month with our board and our member CEOs to get input from our member cooperatives about our strategies. We have a triple bottom line of affordable rates, reliability of service, and environmental stewardship. We do serve a different type of customer than the investor-owned and publicly-owned utilities. This is national data. GRE system is about what you see here in the cooperatives column. We serve, our member co-ops serve about 7 customers per mile of distribution line, a lot lower density. The revenue per mile of line is lower, and it's just a different makeup of customers. And our residential sales really drive our company. We have 58% of our sales going to residential customers by megawatt hours, and 40% to commercial and industrial customers. So much different makeup to co-ops nationally and in GRE system than to other types of utilities. It means we have a much lower load factor than other utilities, and our load curve is much much more driven by peak demand times, driven by weather. For our member cooperatives, about 70% of the power bill that they issue to their distribution customers is made up of wholesale costs from Great River Energy, and about 30% of the cost is made up of distribution. Our average member rate has increased at about the rate of inflation, but as I mentioned, our 2015 rate actually went down from $72.2 per megawatt hour to $71.9 per megawatt hour in 2015. And again, our expectation is the rate increase will be less than 2% a year going forward, so somewhere at or below the rate of inflation. Now, one of the big drivers of our rate increases over this time period that I just mentioned was the doldrums in member energy sales. We were a very fast-growing system 2005 through 2008, and even prior to 2005, we were growing at 5 to 6% a year. That has stopped. We're not growing anymore. In fact, if anything, we're declining a little bit. And you can see the weather variability of our system. That's driven by the fact that we're highly residential. 2015 was a very mild weather year, both winter and summer, a very low sales compared to 2014. We expect that to rebound somewhat in 2016. But we still won't be as high as we were in 2008 in terms of member energy sales. And residential construction in Minnesota is really a driver of growth for us. And look at how many housing starts we had in the mid-2000s, and then the advent of the Great Recession really stopped that. The other interesting thing about this slide is the housing units have rebounded here in 2015 and 2014 in Minnesota, but we're getting a smaller percentage of that in co-op territory than we were getting in the mid-2000s. So while there has been a rebound for Minnesota, it's not happening as much in our service territories. And that affects the denominator of this calculation. The costs are on the top, as Excel mentioned. For us, on the top, we've got our revenue requirement, which is required to recover the cost of serving our member cooperatives. And the denominator, that it gets divided by our billing units, are our kilowatt hours of sales. In this market, more kilowatt hour sales is better from a rates perspective because we got very low incremental cost in this wholesale market today. The top drivers on our cost, as I mentioned, plant investment for reliability and efficiency of our plant and our transmission lines. Fuel cost, that's coal. That's the cost that's going up for us, but it's still very competitive. Emissions reductions, we're investing in that. We're investing in renewable energy additions, and we're experiencing changes in the wholesale energy market that appear to be permanent. In terms of billing units, residential growth has stalled. We had the Great Recession, but even when we rebounded from that, we're seeing less of that housing growth than other areas of the state maybe are seeing. And we're investing in energy efficiency. It makes sense for us to do so, but if you just look at it from a rate standpoint, it is additive to rates, even though that total bill might benefit to that consumer because we're investing in lower usage at each residential location. And distributed generation is a driver for us going forward in terms of stalling somewhat our energy sales. I'll skip over a lot of the details on these graphs in the interest of time, but you can get a feel for our asset position and our net plant. It's really made up by primarily generation and transmission investment. Generation investment is about two-thirds of it, and transmission is about one-third. We are financed by long-term debt of $2.9 billion. The equity comes from our member cooperatives. It's based upon margins on our service, and all those margins are allocated to our member cooperatives every year. That equity is about $600 million. We have a goal to get to 20% equity on our system by 2020. We are on track to meet that. And if you go back to about 10 years ago, we were about 7% equity. So our financial strength is far beyond what it was 10 years ago, and our financial plan is working well. Where do the costs go in terms of the expense categories? Well, about 32% of our cost is ownership. So it's depreciation and interest and taxes on the investments that we've made in generation plant and transmission plant to serve our member cooperatives. About 22% of the cost is fuel cost. That's predominantly the cost of coal, and that's predominantly Coal Creek Station, our flagship plant that's fired by lignite. Still very competitive, but those costs have gone up. Purchase power expense, about 17%. We have agreements with wind power contracts, as well as Manitoba Hydro for purchase power. And then operations and maintenance expense on all of our plant is 27% of our cost, with a very low margin. 2% of our cost is recovered in margin. Now, we have reduced our capital spending significantly, reflecting the fact that we're not growing as a system anymore. So when we're growing at 5 to 6% a year, you can imagine it took a lot of capital investment to keep up with that growth. The Great Recession stopped that. We quickly adjusted our capital spending plan. And most of what you see here in spending from 2010 to 2020 is for transmission investment, CapEx, and local transmission investment. We do track for our members the cost of environmental compliance as a percentage of their rate. It runs to about 12 to 14% of the cost of serving our member cooperatives. The cost of the renewable energy standard is included in this figure. At last measure, it was about half of the cost. You know, it's a reflection of what's happening in the market. You sign a PPA deal for a wind farm, and you lock in a price for buying that wind, but the value of that energy in the market is lower than the PPA price, and that's just a feature of the market right now. We do get some benefit from the investments, though, we've made in environmental controls at our power plants. So a lot of these reductions are voluntary. Some of them were required. We have 56% less sulfur dioxide emissions since 2006, 40% less NOx, 20% down on CO2, and actually in next year will be down even more. Mercury is down 40% on our system. And we're benefiting from the reliability investments we've made. Our reliability is strong for our member cooperatives, and it's improving. And no longer do we have the days where people expect to have lower reliability just because they're served in a rural area. They kind of they expect the same reliability as urban consumers do. So our reliability is strong, and it's improving, and stacks up pretty well nationally. So summary again, I mentioned the drivers. The market's not going back to what we saw before, and we're all adjusting to that. And I think in the future, policy will need to adjust to that. But our future outlook is really about transitioning the portfolio in a way that keeps our rates competitive and manages costs to our members, and being on that trajectory of rate increases of somewhat less than 2% a year. Thank you for your time, and I'll take any questions.
Representative Hortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Brecky. The quote about the number of employees, is that at GRE or does that include your member co-ops?
Thank you, Representative Hortman. That number is the employees of Great River Energy alone.
And then on cost drivers, I wonder, you didn't talk at all about security or natural disasters, and I wonder if those are much of a factor.
You know, that's a great question, Representative Hortman. Certainly If you think of this in terms of drivers facing our industry, that is a major driver facing our industry. It's probably not a major cost driver facing our industry. We're hardening the system, though, and it's really about reliability and weathering storms. So that is one of the cost drivers here in terms of plant investment and reliability. But, you know, cybersecurity is a major issue that utilities are facing, It's probably not one of the top five cost drivers, though, and hopefully it'll stay that way. But it certainly has our attention, and it's one of the top priorities facing the industry.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe that North Dakota's number for reductions in the Clean Power Plan is at 45%. Your flagship is the Coal Creek Station. How do you anticipate meeting the numbers that have been dealt to you by that plan?
Well, that's a great question, Representative. Thank you. The 45% reduction is a rate-based reduction. If you look at it from a mass-based standpoint, it's about 38% reduction in North Dakota. Now, let's just say for the sake of example that let's say North Dakota chooses a mass-based approach if the Clean Power Plan survives the court challenges that are in front of the district court in Washington right now. If they're looking at a 38% reduction, they'll have allowances for 60% or so of the existing emissions of the power plants. So that'll get us a major way towards sustained operations of the coal fleet in North Dakota. It's about 60% of it can remain just by the allowances North Dakota will get. The rest of it is, we've long been a proponent of trading as a solution to the carbon reductions in this country. And I think trading will be the way that North Dakota can specialize in coal-fired energy production in the future by the acquisition of affordable allowances from other states that have taken action beyond what's required in the Clean Power Plan. North Dakota is going to be at about a $22 million allowances a year given by the federal government, by the EPA, to North Dakota and distributed presumably to power plants in North Dakota. So that's $22 million allowances. They emit about 33 million tons today, so that's a deficit of about 11 million. Just looking at the state of Texas, Texas alone will get 190 million allowances. They're not going to need them all. They've already said the Clean Power Plan in Texas is not going to cost them anything. We expect they could well be sellers of surplus allowances. So the market may be a way to acquire allowances and keep plants in operation while contributing to the reliability of the system. People forget it's not just about the reductions that are required. It's also we got to maintain a reliable system. So North Dakota can make great contributions in that regard, we feel, with if the Clean Power Plan survives and if an allowance-based method is chosen, we feel there would be a very active market for carbon allowances nationally, and will make a lot of sense for us to be a part of that market.
Further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Warren Logtuck. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Warren Logtuck from Otter Tail Power Company in Fergus Falls. And when I first accepted this role of being the cleanup hitter tonight, behind my colleagues, I assumed I would be the last person standing between you and your dinner. But I understand that role falls to Mr. Grant now. So, but knowing that, I decided to simply go with a one-page handout for you tonight.
I'm sure Mr. Grant appreciates you highlighting that.
Best presentation so far.
So, it's always difficult to get someone to come from my hometown and spend 6 hours on the road and 2 hours at a meeting in a single day to make presentations like this. So you don't get the rate expert today. You just get the company's lobbyist. But I would reiterate much of what my colleagues have said before me. They've aptly described the pressures that are on electric rates. Most specifically major asset additions, new transmission assets, new environmental controls, and new renewables. New investments, like have been described, those are the things that drive costs, and costs drive rates. There was a period of time of almost 20 years when we didn't have a rate case and we didn't raise rates, and that was because we were not going through an investment cycle. We'd been through a large investment cycle previously. But as we get to the early 2000s, we come upon a new investment cycle. So I thought what I would do with the handout is take a space of time between rate cases for my company As I mentioned, we didn't do a rate case for almost 20 years, and then we, in 2010, filed a rate case. It was completed in October of 2011, and that brings us to today, March of 2016. And if you look at the graph that I've got, I thought if we express this in terms of a monthly bill, that might be helpful for everyone. And if you look back to October of 2011, I didn't get this number on the graph. I had it initially in this quarter. This is for 850 kilowatt hours. That's a typical customer for Otter Tail Power, a residential customer. And setting aside the customer charge of $8.50, well, including the charge of $8.50, a customer would be paying about $80.96 a month back in October of 2011. Since that time, we have made some major investments, as have been described by the other utilities. First in red, these are the what we call the rider-eligible transmission upgrades, primarily the CapEx 2020 project. Now, there you see an additional $3.18 is on our rider. I will add that back in 2011, there were already about $3.66 of CapEx baked into that blue bar that you see on the left. Since 2011, we've also undertaken a major environmental upgrade at our Big Stone plant in South Dakota, and that is on the environmental rider, and that's about $5.47 additional. Now, in purple, you can't see this on paper. It shows up on a computer screen, but not on a piece of paper. What's in our environment, our energy efficiency demand side management rider right now is only about 10 cents a month. And that's largely because within the bar on the left again, there are $3.90 already included for demand side management expenditures that were included in rates in 2011. So that brings us to our bill on the right, which is $89.71. If you back out the $8.50 customer charge, that's about 8.5 cents a kilowatt hour back in 2011, and today it's about 9.5 cents. All of this was accomplished at the same time sales growth is increasing by about 1.5% per year. So from this, I'll just offer a few conclusions. Again, asset investments are what drive rates. The assets that we deploy are, as is described in regulatory parlance, as used and useful for our customers. Those, the approval for those assets are developed over a fairly lengthy period of time in our integrated resource plans together with the Department of Commerce and the Public Utilities Commission. And in the end, they get approved. They have to be approved by the Public Utilities Commission as used and useful and prudent for our customers. And then the last thing I'll mention is that when we source assets, particularly generation assets, we always try to do as low cost or as least cost as possible. Now, what you didn't see in the bars that were on my graph is anything related to renewables. That's because the renewables that we've done were completed by the time we did our rate case in 2011. So those are baked into the $80.96. And that gives us a number system-wide. We're at about 19.5% system-wide renewables. So the only way we can bring those to the commissions in Bismarck and Pierre is we have to show them that they're least cost on behalf of our customers. And indeed, we've been able to convince commissioners in Bismarck and in Pierre that our wind has been resourced as a has been purchased at a least cost resource. So I think they're a good deal for customers. And Mr. Chair, that's all I've got, unless someone's got questions.
Thank you. Questions from the commission? Representative Groffalo.
Thank you. You know, Otter Tail sometimes gets kind of like the forgotten investor-owned utility, right? Everyone assumes that your guys is, you know, everyone understands the difference between IOUs and co-ops, and but people kind of forget the difference between yourself and Minnesota Power, yourself and Xcel. What would, in terms of defining Otter Tail versus other investor-owned utilities. Highlight the top three biggest differences that you think it's important for us to understand.
Between Otter Tail and the other investor owns, or Otter Tail and the co-ops and munis?
No, that's the other investor owns.
Oh, okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, off the top of my head, probably what makes us unique from Xcel and Elite to some degree is we're more diversified as a corporation. Coming upon low growth in the mid to late 80s, we decided to invest in our shareholder earnings and activities outside of our core electric utility assets, and so we own today six or seven companies outside of Otter Tail Power. We are probably unique from Xcel in one respect, and that is that the vast majority of our customers probably look more like co-op customers in terms of median income, for example. I think I've given testimony here before that our median-sized town is only 220 people, so half the cities that we serve have fewer than 220 people. So I would suggest that we have more low-income folks than the co-ops do. Farmers are probably better off today than lots of folks who live in very small towns in Minnesota. Now, I'll add that obviously Xcel would have lots of those kind of folks as well. So, and probably we're unique from Minnesota Power in that we're a small company that does business in three jurisdictions. So that means we have to work with three utility commissions. And utility commissions in different states don't always see eye to eye precisely, particularly if you look at the utility commissions in the Dakotas and the utility commission in Minnesota. I'm not suggesting that's either good or bad. They just have different perspectives on the world. And so we need to describe what we're doing as best we can to all of our commissions, and we always do our best to act in the best interest of our customers.
Thank you. One question based on one of the points you made at the end about how when you have to show lease costs for North Dakota and South Dakota with your renewables, do you, in other words, if you're using one-fourth of your renewables in your Dakota customer base, do you charge one quarter of the wind resource to them, or how do you, when you're dealing with them and you show, you said it's been lease costs, you've shown that. I'm just curious.
Mr. Chair, when we total up all of our costs for renewables, we spread them evenly among all of our customers, regardless of the state that they reside in, and the Dakota's commissions have been convinced by our arguments that those are prudent investments on behalf of our customers in the Dakotas as well.
Thank you. Any other questions? If not, thank you very much. And Mr. Grant, welcome. I'm sorry I only asked you a couple of days ago, and I understand you do have a PowerPoint, though not a handout. Welcome to the commission.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Just one moment while we get the technology sorted out here. Looks like I'm going to be giving the Otter Tail presentation.
You can do it in reverse.
This computer is up.
The house or LEC?
Yeah, it's the laptop. There it is.
So, sorry for the brief delay. I think you're going to hear, Mr. Chairman, more agreement from the department than disagreement with the presentations you've just heard, but maybe a few different points of emphasis. As you've heard from the utilities that have been up to speak to you already, cost drivers are somewhat utility-specific. They tend to follow major capital investments. Renewable rate impacts, as you've seen, have been pretty nominal. Energy efficiency rate impacts have been very small, and as I'll show, the economic benefits associated with those investments have been quite large. And the overall trend seems to show a continued upward pressure on rates. And clearly one of the factors there is declining load growth on a lot of utility systems. This chart shows cumulatively what we've seen in terms of utility rate increase requests over the last 5 years or so. The amount that was requested in the first column, the amount that was authorized by the commission after our recommendations in the second column, and then the total ratepayer savings in the final column. You can see that from what's been proposed to what has been finally approved, ratepayers have saved about half of the cost that would have been the case had their rates not been reviewed by the Public Utilities Commission. Some of the cost drivers that you've heard about from others, I'll repeat. Fuel costs have been a major factor. Transmission costs, and we've been struggling with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission over an issue related to the return on equity for transmission costs that have had a significant impact on the total cost that ratepayers have had to absorb from transmission investments. For those utilities in the state, only XL, that have nuclear costs, that's been a major driver, and you've heard already about the issue at Monticello. And then various riders that the legislature has authorized have put a lot of upward pressure on rates as well. Everything from transmission projects to environmental compliance projects have found their way into riders that take them out of rate case review and onto a separate path. I mentioned that fuel costs have been a real driver, and you can see that here, and fuel costs are actually not something that gets included in rate increase requests. We have an automatic adjustment process for fuel costs in this state, like many other states. And you can see what's been happening to coal costs over the last several years. They've been going up quite dramatically, and we can talk about the reasons for that if you'd like.
Mr. Grant, which one is the lignite? Is that the top, the flatter line? Or
The lignite line is the top line, yes, okay. Mr. Chairman. Turning to renewable energy, every year the utilities report to the commission on their renewable energy standard compliance costs and the rate impacts that have been associated with that. The resource planning process that we go through provide a lot of guidance on the pricing needed to recover renewable energy costs in order for them to be cost effective. Investor-owned utilities need to show that specific renewable energy additions are cost effective before they can go into rates. And so far, no utilities have sought any off-ramp protection from the renewable energy standard. And I don't want to speculate as to the reasons why, but I think the fact that renewable costs have been low and declining over time is a big part of that. Turning to energy efficiency, I want to talk about a study that we had completed recently. This is a study that came out of the SIP R&D fund that utilities pay into, and that we collectively decide what projects to fund. One of them was to really look at what kind of costs and benefits are associated with the Conservation Improvement Program. And the study looked at things from the utilities perspective, the society's perspective, the perspective of a non-participant, those who don't take advantage of SIP programs. It's known, also known as the ratepayer impact measure. And then some of the economic indicators that the report found. This was the results were based on SIP activities occurring over a five-year period between 2008 and 2013, and it assessed the impact of the net benefits that accrue from those 5 years of activity through the year 2032. And the reason for that is that nearly all conservation investments have at least a 15-year life associated with them, so it's important to look at the benefits over time. We assess the cost effectiveness from, as I said, a variety of perspectives, including that of the utilities and of society, and did some estimate of the impact on statewide electric and natural gas rates out through 2032. What we found in terms of the rate impact piece was a very slight upward pressure on future rates through 2022, something equal to about 0.5% of the average monthly residential electric bill. This didn't include, of course, what the impact would have been on rates in the absence of SIP and the need to build additional generation, transmission and distribution to cover the additional kilowatt hours or therms of gas that would have needed to be distributed. It also doesn't include for those participants, what their rate impacts would be. And in most cases, of course, they would see their rates going down after making efficiency investments. What we've also found is that the Conservation Improvement Program has avoided the need to build approximately 3 640 megawatt natural gas combined cycle power plants. So it's been a significant benefit to consumers who would have otherwise had to pay for those plants. Turning to the utility perspective, and this is really a measurement of the net cost of SIP as a resource option from the utility perspective. And of course, most resource options have a positive cost. What we found is that SIP actually provides about a $3 billion net benefit to the utility, again, from avoided investment in new plant and equipment. For this reason, it finds that overall SIP programs have been highly cost-effective investments. From society's perspective, and this is a measurement of net costs as a resource option from everyone's perspective, consumers, utilities alike, and here we found that SIP generated over $3 billion in net benefits to the state and its citizens in that five-year period. And those benefits appear to be going up over time, not down.
Mr. Grant, can I interrupt you?
Of course.
On that last, the societal cost test, is that in effect not with the rate, but in other words, if I'm consuming 10% less power, my bill should go down by 10%, and so even if the rate went up slightly, you're saying
that's right.
So the $3.2 billion is the net lower costs we're paying in terms of
that's right
the rates times the consumption.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Questions from the commission. Very quiet. People ready to finish. If there are no questions, this meeting is adjourned. Thank you very much for the presentation, especially on short notice. Could you get us a copy of the PowerPoint, President?
Finished 20 years early.
Nothing wrong.